Today is July 7th, 2020, and this is episode number 15 of Blurred Laws and Life with me, your host, Richard Bush. So much has happened in the world in the last month or two. In fact, in the last 4 or 5 months. While I thought that COVID would be the story of 2020, and it is, and it is being stubborn and relentless, and new cases on a record pace are being reported every day, in many ways, the news cycle has turned to something different. And my episode 11, The Butterfly Effect, has become, I believe, quite prophetic. Because every day, new developments occur that have all spawned, essentially, from the murder of George Floyd. And what is happening now is, depending upon your viewpoint, either concerning or positive. But it all depends on your particular point of view. I make it a point on Blurred Laws in Life, at least when it comes to the life portion of Blurred Laws in Life, not to necessarily interject my opinions, my personal opinions on certain topics. I discuss the issues and I enjoy letting others reach the conclusions they like to reach, because just like the law, the issues in life are also many times, oftentimes, almost always blurred in some ways. There are exceptions, of course. There are many exceptions, I would have to say. But there are many instances where it's gray. And a few examples come to mind that have been in the news just in the past week. And again, this all emanates, I would say, from the murder of George Floyd. And it makes the butterfly effect even more at the forefront of my mind, because I don't think any of this would have happened but for the murder of George Floyd. So two things in particular that I wanted to discuss this week on this portion of the podcast. There will be a law portion of the podcast as well, where I'm going to discuss several things that are in the news, one of which is a follow-up to my discussion of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and a different problem with the DMCA that is enriching the likes of Google and other internet service providers, but I'll get to that in a moment. What has happened in the past week is that not only have the Washington Redskins now stated that they are looking at changing their name, but the Cleveland Indians have said the same thing, and there have been suggestions that the Atlanta Braves and the Kansas City Chiefs should do the same thing. Again, 2 years ago, Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington Redskins, said specifically that he would never change the name of his team, and he said, you can put that in all caps. But now things have changed. Again, a direct result of the murder of George Floyd, because if that didn't happen, none of this would be happening, I'm confident to say. And so the question becomes, is it offensive to have a Native American nickname in a sports team? There are different sides of it. At first blush, my initial reaction is that a name like the Braves or the Chiefs is not necessarily offensive. And I actually did a little bit of research in preparation for this podcast, and I found out that the Washington Redskins actually got their name because of Native Americans in the Washington, D.C. area who suggested that as a name in the 1930s when the Redskins were changing their name from the prior name, which was named after the owner of the team who had sold the team. So the question becomes whether, you know, that is an offensive name. And I take no position on it because I am not Native American, and therefore I cannot say what should be considered offensive or not offensive. But that raises yet another point, which is, are we in a society where the fact that something might be offensive should mean that it should be canceled? And that raises another issue that has come up in the news. I saw that J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter books, along with several hundred other authors, signed a petition objecting to this cancel culture that we have now. Again, a direct result, I think, of the George Floyd murder, where if something is said that is offensive, or more importantly, I think, if the subject matter of intellectual property, such as a book or a movie or a television show, is offensive, there is a cry to now remove it from publication, remove it from distribution. A few weeks ago, that happened with Gone with the Wind, the movie Gone with the Wind, that has been airing for now 80 years. It was actually removed by HBO for a period of time as a result of this focus now on anything that might be offensive to a group of people. We are now venturing into censorship on a scale that might be considered by some quite dangerous. I saw that there's a Netflix television show that I believe the subject matter is a woman being kidnapped and then being seduced by her captor. And while it is a popular show on Netflix, at least some celebrities have come out and said that it glorifies rape and that it should be removed from Netflix. I also saw that the Smash show, Hamilton, that began streaming on Disney Plus, was actually, and quite unbelievably to me at least, receiving criticism because it did not focus on, or it allegedly diminished, the fact that slavery was going on in the United States at that time. Having watched Hamilton several times, I completely disagree with that. But there are those that are actually criticizing Hamilton for supposedly glorifying people such as George Washington and maybe Thomas Jefferson, who may have had slaves. So the question is, and this gets to the First Amendment, and so I do believe this is appropriate for blurred laws in life because we are a nation that is built on the First Amendment, and we ridicule book burning that went on in Nazi Germany and in other places. In fact, book burning has gone on right here in the United States by those who are opposed to the content of books, for example, teaching science, teaching evolution rather than creation. I've seen that before. So the question now becomes whether we are becoming a nation that is so politically correct, perhaps, or so focused now on not offending any particular group through content that we are trampling, perhaps, upon First Amendment rights. Of course, the First Amendment goes both ways. The First Amendment gives the right to speak freely, to complain, to protest, of course, and to voice one's objection. But the question becomes whether in this society, content that is protected by the First Amendment should be removed simply because it offends or does not adequately address certain issues such as slavery vis-a-vis Hamilton, or because it is subject matter that some find objectionable, such as the program on Netflix that I mentioned a moment ago. And these are not easy questions to answer. I don't pretend to have the right answer. I am Jewish. If there was a movie that existed, a television show that glorified Nazi Germany and glorified Adolf Hitler, I am sure I would not be happy about that. So I don't believe that I have the right or can say that those who object to other content are wrong. But the question is, where does censorship begin? Where should it end? Should we only have Disney movies that have no objectionable content and that are unobjectionable to all? This is art. And there are different viewpoints, and there are no right black and white answers. And that is why this podcast, Blurred Laws and Life, I think is ripe for our time. I just enjoy throwing these issues out to this audience and letting you make the decisions or think about these issues. Many people who listen to this podcast are clients and friends who enjoy talking to me about it afterwards. And this is a great way to communicate with all of you and to try to get you all thinking about these issues that I see and that I think about on a daily basis. Last week on Blurred Laws in Life, I spoke about, among other things, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And I spoke about, in that regard, the overreaching burden that is placed on intellectual property owners to identify links that have unauthorized and infringing material on it, and the safe harbor that is provided to internet service providers, wherein they do not have liability if they take down that link upon a takedown notice. And the further problem that arises because that same content, albeit in a different link, can be put back up. The infringement can begin again and anew, and the intellectual property owner has the burden once more of finding it and identifying it and sending it another takedown notice, and this can go on ad infinitum. There is one other issue that has been a thorn in the side of those owning intellectual property, and that allows a company like Google to get away with murder. And this has been an issue that has been addressed or attempted to be addressed in Congress and otherwise, but so far to no avail. And that is the compensation that intellectual property owners received from the use of their intellectual property on Google and YouTube. Not only do they have no control over the amount of money they are being paid, while Google makes billions of dollars from advertising revenue, and a more pronounced heist of the value of intellectual property comes from a much deeper issue that has yet to be addressed, but should be. And that issue is the fact that YouTube's practice, their policy is to refuse to pay revenue share of intellectual property retroactively after they are caught infringing intellectual property using what is called content ID. So there is content ID for each link on which YouTube has intellectual property and for which they have advertising and receive advertising revenue. Artists, songwriters, those who own intellectual property don't have access to that content ID in the first place. They have to many times find out about the content ID numbers on which their intellectual property is appearing on their own. And if Google gets caught using the intellectual property through content ID that they were not disclosing to the artist, to the songwriter, they do not pay the advertising share retroactively. In other words, if the artist or songwriter finds out that there is a content ID link that contains the intellectual property and notifies Google of it, Google might begin paying a revenue share, albeit a very low revenue share, which has generated massive complaints in the industry prospectively, but they do not go back and make up the money retroactively. And of course, if they never get caught, they quietly keep all the money. There is a content ID tool that might be made available, but it is very difficult, as I understand it, to navigate, and it is certainly not comprehensive in the ability to match the intellectual property with the content ID. While major record labels use this content ID system, as I understand it also, because it is not in any way, shape, or form comprehensive, they have to employ other tools to identify the use of their intellectual property, which is incredibly expensive and may, in fact, ultimately outweigh the cost of what they discover or the revenue they will receive when they discover. And if the major record labels are having a difficult time doing that, you can imagine what an individual songwriter or artist or music publisher has to identify all of the uses of their intellectual property on the internet, or on YouTube, I should say. And while I have not seen the agreement, my understanding is that any user of the content ID system has to enter into an agreement with Google that limits the remedies that are available if you do catch the use of your intellectual property being used without compensation. As I mentioned, while Google may begin compensating the intellectual property owner going forward, they do not do so retroactively. This is a further problem. I am an artist advocate. That is what my practice has been built on. That is what I have done for the last 20 years, essentially represented artists and smaller music publishers and smaller production companies whose work has allegedly been infringed and who have been deprived royalties that they believe they were owed. I still, after all of these years, am at a loss as to why we go to such lengths to protect those who are facilitating infringement. While the DMCA sounds like a positive in theory, because it allows the internet to thrive without companies like Google and other internet service providers being the subject of massive litigation, which would never end. It would overrun the entire judicial system if everyone whose work was being infringed on YouTube filed a lawsuit. It has also incentivized this unfair system in which, number one, it is almost impossible for owners of intellectual property to identify all of the uses of their music and other works that are being used without permission. And number two, it creates this system where the internet service providers can themselves hijack work under the auspices of lack of knowledge, but yet financially benefit from it at rates they set and without compensating those whose work is being taken. And then even when caught, can use their power to only compensate prospectively and not retroactively. This is the same issue that I mentioned that I have and have had with the Music Modernization Act of 2018. Spotify has been sued in class actions. They've been sued in individual lawsuits involving thousands of musical compositions. They have been the subject of complaints by the National Music Publishers Association that they were infringing on literally in all hundreds of thousands of musical compositions, allegedly. And yet Congress agreed and passed the Music Modernization Act of 2018, which retroactively provided essential immunity from liability if a digital music provider complied with the act. They would not face the remedies available under the copyright infringement statute that everyone else faces. Why are we so concerned about protecting multi-billion dollar companies from their alleged wrongdoing when they get caught? I don't understand it, and I don't think I ever will. There was one other legal issue in the news this week that I think fits right into our discussion on this episode of Blurred Laws and Life, and that is that the musical group Lady Antebellum changed their name because of the connotations that arose from the name Antebellum, a Southern Confederate name, and they changed their name to Lady A. Well, wouldn't you know it, there is another artist by the name of Lady A, an African-American artist, singer, who complained about the taking of her name and raised that issue very publicly. The former Lady Antebellum group and Lady A sounded like they were on the verge of reconciling the issue and reaching some agreement, but ultimately that fell apart, and Lady Antebellum, the former group known as Lady Antebellum, filed a lawsuit against Lady A, in the musical artist Lady A, in federal court, seeking protection for their trademark because they allege that they had trademarked Lady A along with Lady Antebellum years before. But the irony of this was the talk of Twitter. You have a group, Lady Antebellum, who were conscious of the connotations of the Antebellum name and the potentially racist connotations of it, and sought to change their name to Lady A, but ended up actually suing an African-American artist who goes by the name Lady A. You really can't make this up. And that is why we have blurred laws and life, because nothing is black and white, it seems. Everything is gray, and everything in today's world sparks a debate. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of Blurred Laws and Life with me, your host, Richard Bush, and I will be back next week for episode number 16. Hope you have a great week. Take care. Bye.